Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Go For It. I'm your host, Paul Gann, alongside Jeremy Espy. And for the next hour, we will be talking sports and having fun doing it. I want all your ideas, all your opinions, and all your beliefs. And, of course, you will get a heavy dose of our opinion. And if you have an opinion, the numbers to call is 1-646-727-3070. That's 1-646-727-3070. And you can listen to the show at blogtalkradio.com/pgann. That's blogtalkradio.com/pgann. And you can send email messages to the show at goforit.gann@gmail.com. That's goforit.gann@gmail.com. Jeremy?
Hey, Paul. How are you?
Doing well. Doing well. I mean, it's been a good week, great week. Celebrated my wedding anniversary a couple days ago. That was beautiful. And now it's time to get down to the business of talking sports and having fun. All right. Lots of things going on. We're scheduled to be joined by 154-pound title contender Sekou Paul, who will talk to us about what's going on with him and talk about the business of boxing. A lot of things going on recently in the wake of the Floyd Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao thing, situation, and that fight not getting done. And, you know, it's interesting to kind of get the insight of what actually goes on. How does a boxer survive when he's not fighting? Things of that nature. What does a boxer do when he's not fighting financially? All these things. I mean, these are important things. And how does negotiations take place? How do these things get done? What goes into it? So, I mean, it should be interesting to get the take of a fighter, a guy who's involved in those day-to-day things and the guy who's involved in that type of stuff. Also, we want to talk about Albert Haynesworth and that situation. And we also wanted to get in a little bit with the Dez Bryant and his injury. And definitely want to take plenty of your calls. I want to go to Albert Haynesworth. I want to start there. It's been required the past few days to take a fitness test, basically. And essentially, he hasn't passed it. There's a reason for him taking these tests is Albert has skipped out on all the mini camps, all the off-season stuff, all the off-season activities. Been a contract, been a dispute, not necessarily with contract, but what's going on in the new defense. Albert wasn't too happy on having to play the nose tackle position. Last year, Washington played the 4-3 defense, and now they're going to play the 3-4 defense, and Albert is going to have to play nose tackle. He's not happy with that. So Albert set out all the mini camps and all the OTAs, all the stuff he set out. He wasn't there. And Shanahan says, you know what, if you're not going to show up to those, Mike Shanahan, the coach of the Redskins, if you're not going to show up to those things, then you're going to have to go through this fitness test and prove to me that you're in shape and that you're ready to go. They said the guy did lose 30 pounds, but he's not necessarily in football shape. I mean, my thing is this, is this to embarrass the guy, or is this to see if this guy's really in shape? In some respect, I feel like it's almost like to embarrass the guy because he missed out on the OTAs and all the other stuff. I mean, when Albert Haynesworth signed with the Washington Redskins, he signed on to play a defensive tackle in the 4-3 scheme. He didn't sign on to play a nose tackle in the 3-4 scheme. So when the new coaching staff came in, they wanted to change. They wanted to change. Albert wasn't too happy with it, and Albert set out all this the OTAs and the minicamps and all the other stuff. And I think in a lot of ways this is to embarrass Albert.
So
I don't think it's necessarily fair, but I understand why he's doing it.
So you're saying that when he signed his contract was for one position. It wasn't, you know, a player and between the player and the team, and you know that, right, Paul?
No,
you know.
No, I'm saying that Albert signed on to play in a 4-3 defense, and that was
Paul. I think he signed. So you're saying he signed that. Paul.
So I equate this to you. For example, if you signed on for a job to be an accountant, let's say a teacher, for example, you signed on to be a teacher, and they wanted you to be a janitor. Obviously, an extreme example.
Paul,
they wanted you to be a janitor.
That's not like an extreme example. He signed on to play on the Redskins for $100 million. I think, 40 mil plus, I think 40 mil minimum was
guaranteed.
40 mil out of 100 million, so 40 million guaranteed. And you're saying it was more important to him to have an absolute position than to have the 40 million guaranteed?
I think it was his contention.
And in regards to your extreme example.
I understand where he's coming from. I don't completely agree with everything he's doing.
He made a mockery of the organization on the off season. He is supposed to be, and I'm sure you're not, Paul, going to argue. I mean, in terms of the defense, you go out and you pay a guy $100 million, you guarantee $40 million of that. He is supposed to be the leader of the defense, and you think that his off-season actions, that was what a leader should do? Because he got upset because they brought in a defensive genius. As a defensive coordinator, I don't think there's many people that are going to argue Haslett's skills. I mean, maybe you're going to say he's not a great coach, but he has made his mark in the NFL as a great defensive coordinator. And it's well known that he has a 3-4 scheme. And, I mean, they're saying not that they're going to not start the guy or that they don't think he's the right person. They pretty much said they're going to build the front line, you know, around him, and he should have been honored. The fact that he, you know, a player now can basically demand and dictate not only what they're going to do, but what kind of defense is best suited for one player out of 11. I mean,
I'll say this. Albert should have came in knowing that in terms of football, things change, coaching staff change, regimes change, ideologies change. Yes, I agree. He should have came in with that mindset. But I think we can't totally dismiss this guy's feelings here and say, oh, okay, well, he knows what he signed up for. He's making a lot of money anyway. But, I mean, the reality of it is he didn't sign up to play in the 3-4 scheme. He signed up to play in a 4-3 scheme. Now, granted, he can get back the money and just walk away from this, but who in their right mind would give up $20 million? I mean, I'm not, and I don't think you would either. But all I'm saying is we're so quick to come down on this guy and say this guy is doing this, and he's a dog for not doing that and not doing the mini camps and all this other stuff. But the reality of it is you know, you don't have so much of a shelf life in this game, and you want to be able to walk and be able to enjoy your children and all this other stuff when the career is over. And there's a chance now, not saying it will happen, but, I mean, this is a guy who believes that with that in place, he won't be able to – he wanted to basically to play the 4-3, and now he has to play the 3-4.
And are we supposed to – is that what you're saying, Paul, you know, start shedding – insert tears here? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Because, I mean, do I feel bad for this man? Because I think you said it as you know, you were going on and on. He could give the money back, and he could just retire, right? That's a viable option.
He could theoretically give the money back and sign somewhere else. He could, but I'm not giving up $20 million, and I don't think he should give up $20 million either. I don't think he's a fool.
So I think he should just shut his mouth and get to playing football. And I mean, if he's a great defensive player, then he's going to be a great defensive player.
He showed up to training camp. He's going through the drills and the exercise, not passing the fitness test, but he's continuing to go through the process of going through the fitness test and trying to pass it.
Paul, and I mean, I know you may not agree, but he made a mockery of the coach, you know?
He did. Yeah, I mean, it's understandable that he didn't come in with the right mindset and the right attitude to be a part of the team. And it's understandable why the coach is doing what he's doing to him, Coach Shanahan. Mike Shanahan doesn't play, so it's understandable. All I'm saying is this, that, I mean, in some respect, maybe you're embarrassing the guy and by making him do this fitness test and everything. But I understand why he's doing it. I definitely understand why he's doing it. And you definitely want the guy in football shape. It's just like a boxer. You want a boxer when he steps into the ring. He has to be in boxing shape. He should be in boxing shape, but it's up to him if he wants to be in shape. Ultimately, as a boxer, you're going in there alone by yourself. So if you're not in shape, you affect your situation, not anyone else's, your situation. But Albert's, unfortunately, affecting the team. And speaking of boxers, we are now joined by 154-pound title contender, Sekou Powell. Sekou?
Hey, how you doing? How you doing, Paul?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing really well. I can't complain.
Now, Sekou, you fought in March, and you got revenge against DeAndre Lattimore. How did it feel to get the W in that fight?
Oh, man, redemption was sweet. I wanted to prove to not so much myself because, in my opinion, I felt as though I should have won the first fight. I came in with the wrong attitude and mindset. But I just wanted to prove to the fans and to the boxing community that this guy was not better than I was. You know, I just wanted to prove that I was the better fighter between me and him. You know, not saying that he's not a good fighter, but just I just wanted to prove that I was better between us.
Now, you fought him the first time. He beat you. You tested positive for marijuana after the fight. What did you learn from that?
Well, I mean, I learned a lot. I learned that you have to take every opponent serious. You know, he was a guy that I met in training camp prior to us fighting. We both helped Jermaine Taylor get ready for a fight with Kasim Umar at once upon a time. And, you know, I had a chance to see him in the training camp. I was not impressed. And I think I used that to make a judgment that, you know, I was going to be able to come into this fight, the fight that we had at the time, and I was going to just be able to have my way with him, you know, and I didn't prepare mentally or physically the way you need to for every competition that you step into the ring for. And that's pretty much what I learned. I learned that regardless of the level of competition or how you view the level of competition that you're going to go up against, you must be in tip-top 100% shape, ready to win. You must be prepared to win. That's what I learned.
Now, you haven't fought since March, and I wanted to kind of move to the business side of boxing for 1 minute. When a guy is not fighting, how does he usually supplement his income? Like, how do you usually supplement your income?
Well, basically, I do personal training. I make pretty good money as a fighter. You know, I'm a top-rated fighter. I do all right. And so, you know, you have to budget yourself. You have to be smart. You know, you have to put funds to the side. You have to market your money. So I'm able to do that. I'm a personal trainer as well, so I do pretty good.
Well, Sekou, quick question in regards to, you just said budgeting your money, but you know, how much control then do you have in regards to decision-making versus, like, your team and your management team?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
When we look, a lot of boxers have, you know, the promoters and they have the managers, and oftentimes you hear where boxers, because they're not so much in control of everything that happens, they'll go out and they'll get a big payday, and lo and behold, a lot of that money it will dwindle down until it gets to the fighter. So how do you, you know, seeing what happens to fighters before you, what steps did you take to prevent that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the one thing you must know about boxing contracts, all contracts are different. Each and every fighter has a different contract tailor-made to him. Depending on how he negotiated for his contract, you know, that's how it's going to work for him. But for me, I was able to negotiate my contract in a way that it was set up. I'm very comfortable with the terms. The breakdown is very fair, in my opinion. You know, and it doesn't break down but so much. I'm getting the lion's share of my purses. And, you know, it's just fair. Everybody's getting their percentage accordingly. And, you know, it's just an even deal. So I'm real satisfied with that.
So now you talk about having to pay the promoter, the trainer, and everyone else. Percentage-wise of the purse, what do you usually come home with, percentage-wise?
I say percentage-wise, out of 100%, I can walk away easily with 85% of my purse, which is a good amount of the purse, you know.
A lot of fighters
don't have that deal. Many fighters don't have that deal. There's fighters that walk away with 60% of their purse or less. You know, depending on how they structured their contract. You know, again, it's all individual. And, like, you know, you just got to have half a brain. You got to use it. You know what I mean?
Now, a lot of fighters, when they first start out, when you first started out, were you able to negotiate good terms, or as you went along, you were able to negotiate better terms?
Well, you know, I came into the professional business with a lengthy and respectable amateur career, so I was able to negotiate right from the start. Lucky for me, I got with one of the best promoters in the business right from the gate, Lou DiBella. And me and Lou DiBella was able to work a really comfortable deal for me, and I'm sure for him as well. But, you know, it was very comfortable for me, and you know, it started out great. We made really good money together. We did a few HBO, a lot of Showtime shows. And so I guess the answer to the question is yes, I was able to negotiate my terms from the start.
Now, in terms of a boxing negotiation, I mean, we've seen recently with Mayweather and Pacquiao and that fight not getting done. Like, what usually goes into a negotiation?
With a fight? Well, I mean, it's usually, as far as money-wise, you know, you got to negotiate on what you're willing to accept, what the promoter is willing to give, and what generally you believe is the fight is worth. You know, usually the network gives a certain amount of money, you know, for the fight, and then from that amount of money, the promoter will you know, see what he sees fit for you and for himself, because everybody has to get paid. So that's pretty much what it's about. It's about, you know, taking the money that's there and divvying it up properly, you know, depending on how the promoter respects you or how your contract is structured with that promoter. You know, you can end up getting, you know, a lot of it to none of it.
Wow.
Yep.
So in regards to, you know, the younger boxers that are out there, you know, and when does the boxer, as you said, and you were lucky to be able to take control early on, but when does that pendulum swing for them? When are they able, you know, to get more and more of the lion's share of that purse?
Well, I think it starts from the start, from the first punch you throw. You want to start negotiating from the start. And your negotiation power, your power to negotiate, is all determined by how successful you are as a fighter. If you're winning fights, if you're undefeated, and you're continuously being successful, you have more and more negotiation power as you go forward. And it's just that simple. The more you lose, the less of a lucrative position you're in, is the less say-so you have, the less demand that you can demand for XYZ, you know. And so if you're out there and you're doing well, just remember, it's about winning fights. It's not about trying to squeeze the last penny out of every fight. Win your fights. If you can continue to be successful and win, you can dictate that. And that's what Floyd Mayweather is a perfect example of, a person dictating his own expenses as far as how he negotiates with networks. I mean, this guy was able to buy his way out of his contract with Bob Arum. He didn't want to have anything to do with Bob anymore. Bought his contract back, which at the time was not a lucrative move. You know, he would have made more money staying with Bob, but this guy had vision. He knew that in the future he was going to be able to dictate his own, you know, his own future. So now he's making tons of money, and there's no middleman getting anything in between.
Now, I understand that some fighters also supplement their income through sparring. Do you do that as well?
Nah, sparring partners are punching bags. When you decide to make yourself into a sparring partner, you're going into top-notch boxing camps, and you're taking a pounding. They're giving you money,
right.
But you're getting beat up. You know, that's not the kind of that's not very lucrative. And not only that,
okay,
sparring partners, after a certain period of time, in my opinion, develop what I call a sparring partner mentality, where
right.
They feel as though, you know, like they're always second best, and they take that same attitude into their own competitions. And you know, it forces them not to be successful. So I'm not I've never been a big endorser of sparring for money, going to different camps for money. I did it earlier out, but it wasn't for the money. It was for the experience. You know, I was
okay,
able to go to Antonio Margarito's training camp. I did a training camp with Jermaine Taylor. You know, those few little training camps that I did was more about me gaining that world-class experience. It wasn't about the money. You know, fighters who do that for the money don't, in my opinion, don't really have a future as fighter, as a champion fighter.
So essentially, you did it for on the job training, basically.
Basically, absolutely. You know, I just wanted to see what that level of competition was like at the time. I was still a 4-round fighter. You know, I probably just went up to 6 rounds. So I just wanted to get in with the best. You have to measure yourself by the best, in my opinion. You know, when you're measuring yourself, if you can measure yourself against the best, you'll know exactly where you are. And that's basically what I was trying to do at the time.
Now, in terms of, I always wonder, in terms of health insurance,
right.
Does a guy like you take out their own policy, or is it through the promoter? How does it work?
Well, I mean, you don't get health insurance. I mean, like I said, all contracts are structured differently. Maybe a promoter, a fighter out there is smart enough to you know, add that into their contract, and that's a part of the contractual agreement that they have with somebody else. Or, you know, you have to go out and get your own. You got to go and get your own insurance. You know, you need to be insured as a fighter. You know, you use your body to make money, so you got to make sure that you know get taken care of.
Right, and that makes plenty of sense, because
you
definitely do have to look out for yourself.
You know, you're using your body. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you look at the 154-pound division right now. I hear a lot of people want to crack at Alfred Angulo, a guy who some believe has been protected on his way to the top. Do you want to shout at Angulo?
Well, I've been chasing Angulo around the boxing community for about 3 years now, and to no avail, of course. I mean, those guys are pretty smart, Gary Shaw and those guys. They're not slow. They know Sekou Pau equals high risk, low reward right now, you know. And so
right.
I respect the fact that they wouldn't step up to the plate and give me a shot, because, you know, you get beat up for nothing. You don't make any money. All you do is lose, and I respect that. So, I mean, hopefully in the future, after I get this belt, after I get this IBF championship, maybe we can get him in the ring. You know, who knows? It might be possible. But at this point in time, those guys are not looking my direction. I tried everything. I tried every trick in the book that I know, besides, you know, just going up and just saying something disrespectful to the guy. I tried everything, and like, nothing. I can't get a fight with him. So I'm thinking the only way I'm going to be able to get that guy in the ring is after I get a championship belt, and it's lucrative for him. So, you know, that's pretty much how that situation is right now.
So in a lot of ways, do belts equate to more opportunity and more money?
Totally. The belt equates to more opportunity 100%, because a lot of these promoters know that the only way to make real money is with a world championship. You know, these networks like to hear world title event. They like to hear world champion. They like to know that the guy that they're watching, the guy that's being endorsed as a world champion. And, you know, a guy like Angulo is only but so far he can go before people are saying, well, why isn't he world champion? You know, they're saying he's, you know, big bad this, big bad that. Why isn't he a world champion? So my plan is to maybe get the belt, you know, not even maybe, but to get the belt, and then maybe call him out, give him a shot at being a world champion. And then I'll get my shot at showing the world that this guy is a good fighter, but not the best in this division.
And then right now, if we look at the IBF champion is Corey Spinks. He
right.
has a fight coming up on August
right.
7th against Cornelius Bundrich, excuse me. And
right.
so you essentially would like to get the winner of that particular fight.
Yeah, that would be a good look for me. I'm in line for a winner. I'm in line for the winner of the Spinks Bundrich fight. You know, I'm the IBF mandatory challenger to the belt. So whoever wins that fight August 7th, I should be the one challenging them next. And I plan on winning the championship, regardless if it's K9 Bundrich or if it's going to be Corey Spinks. You know, I see myself beating both guys. I got respect for those guys, but I see myself, you know, having my way with both guys, and that's just how I feel about it. And
once I get
the belt, you know, I move forward.
And then that's what it's all about, is getting those belts and getting opportunities.
You have the belt,
swagger, very evident. You're a very confident young man. So what is next? what's next for you? You want the winner of that fight we talked about on August 7th.
Yes.
But what is next for you if that doesn't go through?
Right. Well, I mean, I feel like that's going to go through, but at this point in time, like, that is so far into the future that right now me and my team, we're thinking about, we're trying to put something together for like, early September, early to late September, something here in New York City. We want to bring the fans out, put on a show for them, you know, and headline one of these shows in the city. Maybe, like, something at the B.B. King or maybe even something at the Hammerstein Ballroom. Just bring the New York City boxing crowd back out. So we're working on it right now. My promoter, working with my manager, with Lou DiBella, and, you know, a few other people. We're just trying to make it happen.
So we say, Kui, we thank you for joining us, sir. We wish you nothing but the best, and we hope that you do get that title shot and you bring that championship home to Brooklyn.
Oh, man, thanks a lot, Paul, man. I really appreciate you having me on the show today. I just want to thank you first for giving me the opportunity to be heard by your audience. And I just want to thank the fans out there for supporting me. You know, I appreciate
it. Definitely. No problem. Good luck in the future, man. And when you make that fight, we got to bring you back to talk about it.
Let's do it, Paul. I'm all about it, man. Thanks a lot, brother.
Especially when you get that belt, sir. You got to bring it. We got to come back and talk about it.
Yeah, no problem. I'll bring it down to the station, man, and we can do it live.
All right, take care, sir.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Take it easy.
All right.
So now that was
154-pound title contender.
Your New York connections did it again there, Paul, and it was actually quite interesting to hear. You know, one boxer's I guess their take or their understanding in terms of how the boxers, you know, have to make it out, kind of really out there on their own. I liked his analogy, you know, in the first punch, and I think that in a way, may have, because it was done so subtly, may have been quite you know, you may not even have heard it, but I think to me that was it was an interesting analogy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and it's a tough game. It sounds like a tough game, a tough situation for many boxers out here. I mean, he's kind of a middle-level boxer. I mean, and he's obviously a highly contender. He's a high contender, definitely. But, I mean, you got a lot of these low-level boxers who don't have the same opportunities, who obviously are not getting the same, not having the same type of promotional contracts that the other guys have. And it's tough for those guys. I mean, they turn into sparring partners and do other things to make a living for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's, you know, the fact that, like anything else in sports, especially, you know, in boxing, you are certainly here today and going tomorrow. And the money, especially in boxing, you know, one fight can certainly either define your career or redefine your career, if you will. And, you know, you get knocked out in the wrong fight and you go from a contender to a pretender. And you know, you may have thought you're hitting a big payday one or two fights away, and then it's gone. And as he, you know, as he said, boxing is a sport that, you know, can be brutal on your body.
Definitely. And boxing, just like football, I mean, both of these type of sport, both of those sports, it definitely can be very tough and very hard on your body. And speaking of that, situation out of Cowboys camp, they're big wide receiver, Dez Bryant, big rookie wideout, lots of promise, a lot of people are excited about him in Cowboy country. Well, Bryant went down yesterday, had an injury, a high ankle sprain, set to miss 4 to 6 weeks. Jerry Jones has said has been on record, is really not too happy about how he was injured. Apparently, he was doing practice. It was about two reps left, and Dez went down with the high ankle sprain, and he's going to miss time. He's definitely going to miss time, 4 to 6 weeks. And those high ankle sprains, they tend to stay with you for a while. And Jerry Jones was quoted as saying, "As the thing is, you ask yourself, are we pushing him too hard? Does it happen at the end of practice when players are tired? You generally are more prone to injury when you're tired. I spoke with Dez. He's upset, worried about how many preseason games he'll miss. He really worked hard for us." And those were the comments of Jerry Jones after Dez Bryant goes down with the high ankle sprains. What are your thoughts on it, Jeremy?
I mean, I think in a lot of ways it's did he need to maybe come out there and say something like that? It puts a lot of immediate pressure on the coaching staff. And, I mean, I thought he was a smarter owner than that, I should say. I don't think there was a purpose to that. And if he didn't want him out on the field, well, then, quite honestly, he should have had him on the field. To a large degree, everyone knows that Jerry Jones is a very integral, part of the day-to-day management in terms of, his style of ownership. And I mean, so in a way, it is a criticism of him, of himself, because he hires these coaches and he's very active. And it was unfortunate. I think if you're the Cowboys now, we had on Wednesday, we had Mike Hill on the show, who's picking them to win the Super Bowl, but he caveated that, and he did rightly say, but he wants to see injuries coming out of training camp. And I think, like you just said, a high ankle sprain can stay with him. It can linger all season.
Right.
And that's a shame. For Dez Bryant, I mean, we're not making excuses, and I don't think Dez Bryant is making excuses, or I don't think Jerry Jones was making an excuse. I think it was really just, if anything, out of frustration. You hate to be on the second or third day of training camp and potentially have a player now who will, for the majority of the beginning of the season and maybe even during the whole season, be affected by what was, a freak, if you will, injury.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, I mean, you can understand Jerry Jones being upset. I mean, you can understand everybody and the Cowboys brass being upset. But, I mean, it's a part of football. And injuries happen. Things like that happen during training camp, during preseason games. These things happen. And actually, Jerry Jones actually clarified or tried to clarify his comments, and he was quoted as saying, "I'm not being critical. What I'm being is analytical or trying to be analytical. This is when you all sit down and look at everything you're doing and see if there's some things where you can do to help protect your team better, especially during this time, five, six weeks away from the opening game." And those were his comments in terms of trying to clarify what just happened with Dez Bryant, or his comments about Dez Bryant. I mean, in a lot of ways, with Dez Bryant, I mean, these things happen. This is a part of the game of football. And no matter what you do sometimes, these things happen. And, he got an ankle injury. He won't be out for the rest of the season, unfortunately for him and fortunately for the Cowboys. But the reality is that he will miss significant time, 4 to 6 weeks. And hopefully that's all he will be missing. But we'll have to see what happens. And, if you want to give your thoughts on Jerry Jones criticizing his coaching staff or the Halbert Haynesworth story, the numbers to call, 646-727-3070. That's 646-727-3070. You can listen to the show at blogtalkradio.com/PGAN. That's blogtalkradio.com/PGAN. Or you can send email messages to the show at goforward.gan@gmail.com. That's goforward.gan@gmail.com. And now, a lot of things going around in the NFL, training camps are opening, and it's an exciting time, and it's got to be an exciting time for Sam Bradford. Man, it's a party there. It's got to be a big party in the Bradford household and for generations of Bradfords. I mean, goodness gracious. This guy got paid, and he's never even played a down of football. $50 million guaranteed. $50 million. He signed a six-year $78 million contract, 50 of it is guaranteed, and the contract could be worth as much as $86 million, and this guy has not played a down of football. What a country, what a league.
I think you and I later, as training camp rolls on and we get to see how some of these rookies develop, I know we're going to spend much more time getting into are the rookies even worth it. But, yeah, I mean, $50 million guaranteed. And you would think it's up. They said it was up almost $8-9 million from last year, which last year was, what, $41 million guaranteed. I mean, that's a 22% increase. I mean, I hope everybody else in the country can enjoy a 22% raise. You know, in a way, and this guy hasn't played it down. 50, as you said, 50 mil guaranteed. If he hits himself in stride, he can make himself $86 million before the contract expires or it gets renegotiated. So, but if nothing else, Paul, he doesn't ever have to really worry, as you said, or probably his kids and his kids' kids and maybe their kids' kids may not have too much to worry about for a long time if they can, you know, stay conservative and find a good financial investor.
Yeah, you're right. And you look at Matthew Stafford's contract, $41.7 million guaranteed for him. And he signed a six-year, $72 million deal with the Lions last year. I mean, it's an obvious issue here in the game where you have – it's something that needs to definitely get restructured, something they have to figure it out. Maybe they go the route of the NBA. I mean, with the NBA, a lot of times the guys get paid on their second contract. That first contract usually, I mean, you're talking about $2, $3 million a year for the higher picks. But, I mean, you're saying, I mean, you look at Sam Bradford, you look at a Matthew Stafford. These guys have not played a down of football. These guys haven't played one single down of football.
Well, I mean, but Paul, and you saw, but Tim Tebow, I mean, in reality, it really is the rookie pool and the rookie contract. Tim Tebow walks away with $9 million, $8.7 guaranteed. I mean, you know, there were, before the draft, many arguments saying this guy has really no place in the NFL, if anywhere, maybe as a running back or, you know, a scat back type or a wide out. But he gets $9 million. I mean, and with, I think, incentives, that contract is in the double-digit millions. And again, I think a lot of the NFL's, I think, real issues now, and they talk about these labor disputes, is the huge disparities in these contracts. Whether or not you like Albert Haynesworth, I mean, the guy did prove himself, and he's only got $40 million guaranteed. And to think about, like, the fact that there's a guy that's walking in tomorrow or today and hasn't played it down, may never even start in the NFL, and he's going to be guaranteed $50 million, there's such a disparity. I mean, it really can, and it, I think it will in the NFL. It's going to create a lot of long-term issues inside of the players.
Because you will have a lot of younger players now that I don't think the younger guys are going to be as willing as the older guys. I don't think if I'm Matthew Stafford, 1 year removed, I'm going to be so willing to cast my vote to screw the younger rookies in a year or two when many of them are his peer group.
And you got to also look at veterans in a lot of ways. I mean, if you're a veteran, do you want to help a guy who hasn't played a down of football who comes in making much more money than you do? I mean,
well, this is, and again,
does your attitude now change towards that guy? Does it become a little resentful now that you have an individual like a Matthew Stafford, like a Sam Bradford, like a Tim Tebow coming and making more money than you do, and you have in your career? I mean, $50 million is a lot of money. I mean, guaranteed money, and this guy hasn't done jack. All he's done is proven that he can be very good on the college, very good on the collegiate level. And the NFL, unlike the NBA in a lot of ways, your best bet is to have a great college career, even more so than a great NFL career. You have a great college career, you could come in making buku dollars, $50 million, Sam Bradford, $41 million, Matthew Stafford. I mean, there's obviously something wrong with the system. Hello, you're on the floor.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's absurd that these young kids are coming in making these ridiculous amounts of money when they're just unproven. I mean, let's not forget, you know, Jamarcus Russell, rather. You know, I'm sure Al Davis hasn't forgotten about him, but everyone else has already. And I just think that they should have to come in and prove themselves before they're given these huge, huge contracts, you know, rather than these other guys in the NFL, such as Haynesworth, who has proven himself, and all the scrutiny is put on him now because he can't run 300 yards when he's never going to have to do that in his NFL career in a game, ever. He's going to have to run 300 yards.
And you're right. You make a great point. You make a very, very great point. And in a lot of ways, it's obviously the system is backwards. Because the system is backwards. And $36-39 million Guaranteed dollars that he got. Jamarcus Russell
stinks. Yeah, but let's not commingle. I mean, I think Haynesworth, the issue is a little bit separate. But, I mean, Jamarcus Russell is the and there's Ryan Leaf before him. There are too many, almost too many, especially the quarterback position, you know, rookies who get this guaranteed payout and who certainly don't pan out. Brady Quinn was another, certainly didn't hit the big money payout, but he's now backing up
Tebow.
Well, yeah, he got $20 million, and that, but he wasn't, you know, he didn't get that kind of money.
Well, the list goes on and on. How about Brian Bosworth? How about the ex-Eagle, Mike Mamula? These guys come out of these great college careers and just don't cut it in the NFL.
And I understand you made the point about not connecting the two issues, but in some respect, the two issues are sort of related in this respect. If you look at a guy like Sam Bradford, who making $50 million and hasn't proven anything on this league. Albert Haynesworth has proven that he can play in this league. I think the main thing with the difference is that a lot of people are saying that Haynesworth, in a lot of ways, is dogging it now, that he got his payout and that he's not being a team player in his situation. But we thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, and I think, Paul, there's going to be so much that is it over the – I think, we're going to see it as fans, too, of the NFL so much, I think, in the next 3, 4, 5 months as the season draws near, and certainly with the labor contracts and the labor talks the way they are. I mean, this is a big year for the NFL. I think they really have – I think everyone knows there's going to be a lot of changes, not just to the way the contracts work, not just to rookies or veterans. They're going to add – more games, because the NFL is becoming what used to be a league where, because they had the hard cap and things were very finite, they never had these issues. But it's becoming like every other major sport where, you know, players are hitting these humongous paydays, and players have learned really where the money is and where the money isn't. And so you're seeing a lot of players now that are opting for, you know, that maybe a shorter contract, but less or more money longer contract, but more money guaranteed. And they, you know, where even a guy like Terrell Owens, who you think it's not like the worst thing in the world, but I mean, he knows all he has to do every year is pretty much stay healthy. And, you know, he guarantees himself $2 to $4 million in a contract, you know, at his age. And people are saying, well, you know, how's that playing out for him? And, I mean, he has every year in a large regard had nice payouts for the last, you know, 5 years, even going back to the Eagles. So I think some of these players, it works well for them. But then there are, as you said, veterans who, you know, could and look at Tom Brady, who now is facing you know, he makes, I think they said, like $7 million this year, which is kind of pathetic if you think about it. I mean, considering he's probably in his year the greatest quarterback, and he's going to wait probably through the end of the season to get a deal done here.
And yeah, you're right. And
Brady, one would think a team, you know, would want. Well, and look at McNabb. I mean, McNabb certainly. And I think it's the NFL has become a league where you get above that 30 range and you have not had that major payout, and you may never, you really you won't get it. And because of the way the rookie scales work, they're not going to, and the NFL in and of itself is not going to invest heavily in guaranteed money in a player, you know, above 30, 31, because they can, the role has been reversed. They don't need you because their product in its totality is greater than any one player.
And in a way, and like you said, I mean, way at this stage, the way it is set up, that you have guys that who struggle to get that payday, like you said, at the age of 30 and over. I mean, you struggle to get that payday, and it's got to do something in a locker room where you have this guy coming in like a Sam Bradford making $50 million and having to play one down of football and maybe a bust. And may not, theoretically, he may not play one down of football, in theory. I mean, you never know what could happen, but in theory, he may never play one down of football.
Well, Bradford's going to play. I mean, this year, it's well known. I mean, we will say this. I mean, Bradford will, I mean, he's probably, if he's not going to be starting the season, he'll be in there by the third game of the season. And certainly, you know, how's that going to work for him? Well, I mean, the argument now, I mean, can be made that may be what cost him his career. That, you know, these players, because of the amount of money they're making, and we've heard this argument many times before, because these teams are paying so much money out of the gate, they don't have the patience because they can't afford to have the patience. And we saw it in San Diego a couple years ago. They had Philip Rivers and Drew Brees, and of course, you know, well, arguments are made that, you know, San Diego let go of the wrong quarterback, did they, didn't they? And so, you know, the quarterback position, to a certain degree, is the one where you don't want to be stuck in. It's tough because Bradford's going to walk on a team where he can't do anything this year. They're going to be...
It's not a good team in St. Louis, and he's definitely... most rookie quarterbacks struggle. It's just the nature of the situation. But
I mean, they have a young line. They have no passing game. I mean, they have Steven Jackson, but what can that guy do?
But
when
in some respect, if you think about it, it takes a special person, special competitor to be able to go out there and still want to be the best you can be, even after you have the money already. I mean, think about it. I mean, if somebody lines your pockets with $50 million and, you know,
And you know how I feel.
What becomes your incentive? I mean, a lot of ways you do play football. It's just like any job. You play football to get paid. Now that you've already gotten paid, you know, I mean, in some respect, maybe the pressure is off. You can go out and just you know, maybe it's not pressure at that point. Maybe you can just go out and just let it fly. But in some respect, I think it takes a special person because if you give me $50 million, a lot of us are – Or in some respect, if we have to go to our jobs, we're not going to go to our jobs and try very hard.
No. Well, we heard that from players like Sean's former player, Sean Salisbury, made it clear, you know, that as soon as I think they get into the NFL, that's a business, Paul. And their goal now is to stay employed. I mean, competition, I think, for all the players, if they really want to be honest, is great. But their main goal is to have a very tenured career, stay employed or stay playing as long as possible, and, of course, make the maximum they can make every year. I think that the mindset or the belief that all player wants to do is win championship after championship, well, then why do so many players on the championship teams have the ability to leave the year after a championship leave? Because if you get lucky and you hit the Super Bowl in your first couple of years, then you know your goal is to get the payout in the next couple. And if you never do, and you can make a lot of money, well, then you really are a true winner, in my book. I think that is the hardest part now about, you know, watching all of these sports is the amount of egregious money that's paid to these athletes to basically either throw or bounce a ball.
Well, I mean, that kind of goes to a larger issue. But.
Yeah, and we're not going to, but I think you're going to see. We'll see this year. I mean, we'll see of every one of these major, you know, first rounders that collectively, I think they said in the first five picks it was over $200 million guaranteed in money, just over $200 million. I mean, that's insane when you think about five or six players, $200 million guaranteed money. And most of that is in 3 years. So at the end of the third year, we should go back and see where are the first five, six players. Where did they pan out in 3 years when their guaranteed money stops?
Right.
Because if they're, you know, and, you know, for them, that's great. But if you're a player, for example, if you're a Brian Westbrook, who, I mean, a lot of people think has a lot maybe to offer teams. He, you know, suffered an injury at the wrong time, and his career, for better or worse, is pretty much over, whether he plays this year or doesn't play. You know, because he got an injury, and the Eagles were smart to, you know, to let him play without that contract, you know, he is a loser.
Hello, you don't go for it. Hello? Hello, you don't go for it. All right, because they didn't want to talk back at that time. Westbrook did find a way to get some money before. They did renegotiate his contract where he got some money before everything went downhill. But, again, it's not as much money as he would have made if he would have been the Brian Westbrook, who was a Heisman Trophy winner or a top-flight college athlete. He would have came out and he would have been able to got, you know, made more money. And I want to look at Tom Brady. Tom Brady signed a 6-year extension back in 2005 for $60 million. $26 million of it was guaranteed. $26 million in bonuses. And, I mean, granted, that was 5 years ago. But look at it now. I mean, 5 years later, I guess Sam Bradford doubles that with $50 million guaranteed. And doubling that, I mean, if he hasn't played it down to football, and Tom Brady has won 3 Super Bowls. So, I mean, I think that kind of tells you in some respect, or shows you in some respect, what's wrong with this system. And they got to fix it. Somehow, some way, they got to find a way.
Well, but the problem to reconcile it, and it is, as you said, it's a more global issue. It's all these sports because, I mean, where – I think what one of the transcending issues is all of these guaranteed monies, because whether it's a hard cap like the NFL or soft cap like it is in basketball, and there's no cap really in baseball. I mean, where Alex Rodriguez is making $26 million a year, and it's like you think about that, and I mean, gee, and all of that is guaranteed. Where I mean, it's like amazing. To think about what any of or all of these leagues can do. I mean, and one of these two, you know, we talked about on Wednesday with Mike Hill was with Brett Favre, and you had said it in the show, and it does bear noting, with regards to Brett Favre, it's very well known, like he does not really do a lot to cultivate many of these young players in terms of the quarterback position. And you have been saying, you know, it would be difficult to line up if you're out, for example, if you're Kyle Orton and you're out in Denver and really try to help Tim Tebow, who walks in the latter part of the draft. And I think I saw somewhere that his contract was above 40% greater than the guy that got it last year. And that a lot of that is, like you said, Paul, because Tim Tebow had a Hall of Fame, if you will, college career.
Exactly. That's all it is. I mean, I don't envision Tim Tebow being a quarterback in this league, an every down quarterback in this league, a wildcard quarterback definitely, but an every down quarterback in this league, no chance for Tim Tebow, no shot whatsoever.
But he walks away with $9 million.
And hey, good, what a country! All you can say is what a country. But I mean, if you look at Tim Tebow, I mean, no fault of his own. I mean, hey, don't hate the player, hate the game, but he has done all that he needed to do. And theoretically, you coming from an accountant background with $9 million, could he extend that where it could help? It could be with him for the rest of his life?
Well, sure. I mean, there $9 million is more than enough. We did this session before, but I certainly can do it. I mean, I'll do it every show. So $9 million. You have to take just about 40% of that out for all the various, and there are several taxing authorities. So $9 million of the 40%, he's left with just over, say, $5.5 million, and then 10%, 15% of the gross. So that would be the agents and the so-ons and the so-forth. So you're talking about another about $1 or $2 million. So he'll be left with just about $3.5 million of the guaranteed money after the third year, tax free, and so sure. I mean, $3.5 million if you're 21 and you can't. And remember, Paul, all he really has to do again is play and get that. You know, he's smart too. He's out there now. He's got the underwear contracts and I just read the other day he's now repping for Gatorade, he's repping for Nike, so all the extra little bit of money will certainly help him. But to walk away from $9 million with just about $3 to $3.5 million guaranteed, if he's smart, he puts his money away. He lives on all of his He lives on right now anything he can make outside of football. And, you know, $3 million, you know, that's $100,000 a year probably for 70 years. So he can live, or about 55 years, he can live comfortably with a rate of return in the low to marginal 5%. But again, you know, these guys, and you know this, it's well documented. They're going to go out, and they said Albert Haynesworth rolled up to training camp in the Redskins. I'm sure you read in a Rolls Royce. That's a $500,000 car. So now Albert Haynesworth has $40 million guaranteed. Tim Tebow, we just said, has about $3 to $3.5 million in terms of tax free dollars. So that's a sixth of his, you know, his life's worth. To put that in a car, I don't know if I'd do that.
Well, I mean, I guess he figures that.
But that's the mindset of these athletes, and that's one of the things you and I have said, is that they really should be more careful, be more more prone to saving that guaranteed money than spending it. And but Tim Tebow is not, as we say, not Albert Haynesworth. I mean, Albert picked $20 million up at the Redskins camp in early April. So of that $20 million, you're talking probably $7 to $8 million again is Albert's to keep forever. So, you know, he has about $16-17 million of the last 2 years that are just his. So can he go out and splurge? Sure, if he wants to. But it's a crazy world. It's a fickle world for a lot of these players, because they're used to, I guess when you're used to driving a Rolls Royce when you're Albert Haynesworth, I think he's not, he just about turned 30, so he's your age and my age. So I guess when you're driving a Rolls Royce at 30, Paul, what are you driving when you're 40? I hope it's not a Pinto.
Maybe you're driving that same Rolls Royce.
I hope it's not a Pinto.
You get the oil change on a consistent basis, take care of the engine, make sure everything is going well. Maybe you don't ride it as often. Maybe that's like your play car. So maybe at 40, he could still be driving that same car. Maybe not, you know, the car.
Now we know you would be.
It's not going to be the same, but hey, why not drive it? 10 years from now, maybe that's what he's doing. 10 years from now, hopefully.
Maybe. Good snow tires.
You hope that the guy does have, you know, enough sense to have the money saved, or, you know, to put it away somewhere. You hope. But, you know, I mean, a lot of ways, unfortunately, the way we've seen it, it really doesn't happen that way. And unfortunately, guys tend to go broke a lot sooner than they should. And, well, you hope that guys would be a little smarter. But obviously, they haven't been, and unfortunately, they probably won't be.
Well, I think, too, as you said, it's going to be a long summer. We have much football, much more business of football, I'm sure, with these players. It will be a hot summer, and we'll get a chance to start to see who of any of these rookies and who of these veterans or if Tom Brady does get the money, what a three-time, as you said, Super Bowl champion is worth, who arguably is still, he doesn't throw bad football just yet. So, I mean, I think it should be an interesting August and beginning of September.
It definitely should, and I mean, we'll definitely see how this plays out and see what happens. So I mean, it's like you said. I mean, training camp has started, and then football is on its way. It's on its way. Preseason games start in August, and season will start in September, and we'll be talking football for a long time. So we've been talking a lot from September. Well, we've been talking it now, but you figure from September to February.
And rewind, I mean, in closing, as we learned today from the scholar Paul Gann, I mean, dads and moms out there, don't have your kid focus on the NFL or the NBA. Get him into a good college program, because that's where the money is. Right, Paul?
Basically, make sure you're thinking college. under this system, you don't need to do anything at the pro level. Make sure you're doing it on college. And you
shoot for that Heisman.
One thing, thank Kyle for stopping by. Wish him luck in his next fight, wherever that may be. And we want to thank everybody for listening and everybody for calling. Take care for Jeremy yesterday. Paul Gant, go for it.
Bye.